Well, we're considering this passage from Mark chapter 6, verses 30 to 52. And after spending the last 22 verses outside of the immediate company of Jesus, we now return from Herod's palace down to the lakeside of Galilee. And I want us to observe then three things as we consider this passage this evening. Firstly, let us see the pity of Jesus. The pity of Jesus. Look at verse 39 of our passage. It reads, "Then he," that's Jesus, "commanded them all to sit down in groups on the green grass." So they sat down in groups by hundreds and by fifties. You know, the gospel writers don't have the same approach to writing that J.R.R. Tolkien does. If you read any of the Lord of the Rings books, you'll see that Tolkien's writing is highly descriptive. Every hill, every cloud, every tree, every field, it's all given a unique description. He adorns his books with lengthy details. That's not usually how the gospel authors write their books. Which begs a question then. Why is it that in verse 39 that we've just read, Mark feels the need to tell us the colour of the grass? Why is it green grass? Why is it not just grass? Well, Dr. Peter Williams, Christian doctor, academic, apologist, argues that this is one of those interesting details in the Gospels which authenticates their reliability. So we know from other Gospels that this event happened near Bethsaida. We know that it happened around the time of the Passover, and it just so happens that by looking at the levels of rainfall, which would have been taking place at that in the previous months leading up to Passover at that particular place, it makes sense that the grass would have been hydrated and that it would have been luscious and green. It shows us then that Mark has a good knowledge of the local environment, that the gospel wasn't written by a stranger many, many decades later. It was written by someone who was familiar with the environment and the time of year and everything else. It's one of those details which authenticates the reliability of this gospel. But I think there's another reason why Mark tells us that the grass is green. And that's because ultimately there is an underlying theme in this passage to which green grass is very relevant. And that is the theme of shepherding. It's a theme, of course, that we see most clearly in verse 34. "When he went ashore, he saw a great crowd and he had compassion on them." Why? Because they were like sheep without a shepherd. These multitudes by the lakeside, these crowds which have become a sort of irremovable feature of Jesus' ministry, are compared to these wandering, aimless sheep in need of a shepherd to take pity on them and to impose some order on them and to deal with them in discrete groups of fifties and hundreds and to guide them back into thick, green, grassy pastures to feed them. That's why Mark mentions the grass is green. He's employing this metaphor of shepherding. And what then is Mark's purpose in employing this metaphor of shepherding? Well, for starters, it's a biblical metaphor. Even that very phrase, "sheep without a shepherd," is used several times elsewhere in the Bible. Always it refers to Israel in a state of spiritual or real physical wandering. So, for example, in Numbers chapter 27, Moses is anxious that the people of God don't enter the promised land without a leader. Verse 17 of that chapter, "that the congregation of the Lord may not be as a sheep that have no shepherd." And that shepherding role is ultimately fulfilled by Joshua. Or the prophet Micaiah uses the same phrase in 1 Kings chapter 22, verse 17, referring to the people of Israel without a clear political leader in that moment. And again, he refers to them as sheep without a shepherd. And then most significantly, we saw that idea in Ezekiel chapter 34 that we read a few moments ago, where God accuses the spiritual and political shepherds of Israel of forsaking their duties, of abusing the flock, of not binding up their wounds, not supporting the weak, not feeding the flock, but rather failing to do those things, slaughtering the flock, clothing themselves in the flock's wool, and thus in practice leaving the flock as sheep without a shepherd. And in response to that, God promises to raise up a shepherd king, and in the passage that we read, he promises to be that shepherd himself. And of course, those references which I've just mentioned only represent a tiny fragment of the occasions throughout the Bible when that broader theme of shepherding is used in the Old Testament. And so we must see then that when Mark uses this idea in chapter 6, it's not an original analogy which has just popped into his head. Rather, there is this ancient metaphor of shepherding sitting in the ancient Old Testament scriptures, ready for someone to pick it up, to blow the dust off it, and to reactivate it when the time is right. There's a sense in which, once the Old Testament closes, there remain these sort of vacant positions which haven't yet been filled. The greater king, greater than David, the greater prophet, greater than Moses, the greater priest, these empty offices which are just waiting to be assumed. And by the time then that the last Old Testament author puts down his pen, the greater shepherd office is still vacant as well, as if the Old Testament writers are stretching across the gap to the New Testament and handing over a shepherd's crook and saying, I think you'll be needing this. And as we see here then, Mark puts that crook right into the hands of Jesus. He is the shepherd, and the crowds are the sheep. He's the one which, in the doxology which Mike used this morning, is described in Hebrews 13 as the great shepherd of the sheep. So Mark is choosing this well-worn biblical analogy to cast light onto Jesus' identity as the shepherd that Israel never really had. But more than that, he's using this metaphor because it's sweet, because it's tender, because it's touching. Because what's at the heart of this metaphor? Well, at the heart of this metaphor is Mark wanting to give us a window onto the emotions of Jesus as he looks upon this crowd. That's the heart. He wants to capture the emotional relationship between Jesus and his people. And we're told then that the fact that these sheep are like, these crowds are like sheep without a shepherd, evokes Jesus' compassion. Mark wants us to see Jesus' pity, the sight of lost people, wandering people, unguided people, vulnerable people, hungry people, dissatisfied people. That has an emotional effect on Jesus. He sees the crowd, he feels the crowd, he feels compassion for the crowd. Bear in mind, we've seen lots of crowds in Mark's gospel so far, and sometimes we get the impression that these crowds can be quite boisterous, quite difficult things, preventing Jesus from doing what he wants to do. We get the impression a little bit here in this passage, don't we? That the disciples begin tired and hungry after their season of itinerant ministry. They try to withdraw to a desolate place to rest and eat in verse 31, but the people are coming and going and prevent them from doing that. So in verse 32, they get on a boat to try to get off somewhere to find some peace by themselves. And then yet in verse 33, the crowds are relentless and they're on the move again. They're trying to cut them off before they can get to the land. And you think that sort of experience would be rather exasperating. You think there'd be a point then when Jesus' compassion for these people has to sort of shut down a little bit. At least he's driven into a state of apathy at best, at worst, irritation and annoyance with these people. You get the impression that the disciples have something of that experience. In verse 36, where they say to Jesus, send them away to go into the surrounding countryside and the villages. It's getting late, Jesus. They'll be getting hungry. They can sort themselves out, and then we can make a dash for it and get some peace and quiet. You can imagine how they felt. But that's not how Jesus feels. No, Jesus looks on these crowds, and he sighs at the plight of these crowds. Tears begin to shine in his eyes, and his heart burns within him. And he doesn't abdicate responsibility like the disciples were tempted to do. Rather, he takes responsibility for these sheep like a proper shepherd is supposed to. I think that's why, partly, he goes up onto the mountain in verse 46, at the end of this passage, to pray by himself. It's as if he now feels the weight of these sheep and the burdens upon his heart and the needs of these sheep. He's weighed down by their toils, their oppression. And it's from that feeling of overwhelming compassion then that he now speaks to his father. He has to unburden himself. He has to pray to his God for this flock of sheep. And so in the first place this evening, I just want us to simply put ourselves, as we once were in that natural condition, into this crowd. We were once lost people. We were once wandering people. We were once unguided, vulnerable, hungry, dissatisfied people. And perhaps some of you feel quite like that even still. Perhaps you know what it feels like to be a sheep which has become distracted from the flock, which has wandered off, maybe without even noticing. And the next thing you know, you've lost sight of the shepherd and you're thinking, how have I gotten here? And to all of us then, we need to remind ourselves, we are the object of Jesus' compassion. When he sees you wandering, he pities you. And when you, as a wandering sheep then, catch sight of your shepherd and you, like a poor sheep, go hurtling back towards him, he doesn't see you with a sense of exasperation. He doesn't snap at you and say, you know, where did you get to this time? You've wandered off far too many times for me to let you carry on with us coming any further. There's not any place for you in this flock anymore. He doesn't do that. No, he welcomes you with compassion back into the flock. So it's a simple point, but it's simply this, that Jesus has compassion. He has pity. Observe the pity of Jesus. It's so crucial that we understand this. Don't let anyone tell you that believing in a compassionate Jesus makes you a liberal or mushy or sort of emasculated, feminized kind of Christian. A sort of Christian who doesn't really take the Jesus of the Bible seriously enough. No, rather, taking the Jesus of the Bible seriously enough means seeing him in his full masculine compassion, his shepherding compassion towards his sheep. If we are uncertain about the emotional disposition of Jesus Christ towards his people, then we're missing the very heart of Christianity. Because at the heart of Christianity is this heart of Jesus Christ, and it's a heart filled with compassion for his people. So see here the pity of Jesus. But secondly, I want us to observe the provision of Jesus. The provision of Jesus. Because notice how this passage continues in verses 34 and 35. It says, and he had compassion on them, because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things. He began to teach them many things. You see, the chief need that tugs on Jesus' heart as he witnesses this pitiful group of men and women, that need is a need which he now seeks to address through teaching. That's how he acts on his compassion. That's what he does. He feeds and waters the flock of God through communicating the truths of God to them, by teaching them. That's what he's doing. That's how he meets their need. That's how he executes his compassion. The revelation of God is the thick green grass that these sheep spend their afternoon munching on. That's his provision ultimately to them. But then, as time goes by and it grows later in the day, another need arises as well, and it's a much more practical need. It's the need for real food. I mean, presumably these sheep were so fixated by the teaching of Jesus Christ, a good many of them had actually forgotten about their tea. And we're quite happy to postpone it that evening. And it's this practical need then which Jesus now provides for. He literally feeds the crowd. But given the shepherding metaphor that we've got in the background here, and given this initial emphasis on teaching that we've just mentioned, I think we can say this, that the literal feeding of the 5,000 we are about to consider is itself a wonderful picture of the real feast this crowd have already enjoyed, the spiritual feeding of the 5,000 through the teachings of Jesus Christ. Jesus feeds this crowd's bellies in a way that closely resembles how he first fed their souls. And that being the case then, I think the feeding of the 5,000 has much to teach us about the manner in which we, as the flock of Jesus Christ, are tended to by our great shepherd. And with that in mind, then, I want to consider three further things under this point. Firstly, consider who feeds the crowd. Consider who feeds the crowd. Because you might be forgiven that for thinking that Jesus is the one who miraculously multiplies the bread while it's still in his hands and hands it to the people. But actually, Matthew's gospel and Mark's gospel and Luke's gospel are all keen to point out that the bread doesn't go directly from Jesus to the crowd. No, rather, look at verse 41. He gave them to the disciples to set before the people. That is, the bread is given to the crowd, mediated through the disciples. And in case you think that's just an incidental practical detail, consider the emphasis Jesus puts on this in verse 37. The disciples have just suggested that the crowd should be dismissed to feed themselves. And then in verse 37, but he answered them, "You give them something to eat. You give them something to eat." There must be significance in those words, because if there wasn't significance, it would be a completely absurd thing for him to say. Because both he knows and they know, judging by their sarcastic comment about buying 200 denarii worth of bread, that he is asking for the impossible. So what is the significance? Well, the significance is this, that it's through his people that Jesus shepherds his people. He uses mediators. He uses under-shepherds. He doesn't just zap us with spiritual fruit food with a laser beam straight from heaven. No, he uses his people to shepherd his people. And that means then that sense of compassionate responsibility which Jesus has for these crowds shouldn't be alien to us as members of the flock of God. Rather, we should share with him in that sense of burden. Elders, in particular, who have a teaching responsibility, should share with Jesus Christ in that burden to feed his flock. The disciples are not allowed to shirk their responsibility at this stage. Simon Peter, who presumably here is one of those disciples who ends up feeding the bread to the people, distributing the bread, will one day have to grasp this point very clearly, because he will one day be told on the same banks of Galilee, the risen Jesus will have to tell him these three commands: feed my lambs, tend my sheep, feed my sheep. Peter can't wriggle out of it. He's been given the shepherd's crook as well. And that command on Peter will have an impact, because in a few years down the line, Peter will adopt that same shepherding metaphor as he writes his epistles to the churches. He says in 1 Peter chapter 5, "So I exhort the elders among you, as a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, as well as a partaker in the glory that is going to be revealed, shepherd the flock of God that is among you, exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but willingly, as God would have you, not for shameful gain, but eagerly, not domineering over those in your charge, but being examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the unfading crown of glory." Peter realizes that as a disciple of Jesus Christ, he has a responsibility to shepherd the flock alongside Jesus. And while I think we can say in general, Jesus uses his people, all of his people, in a range of ways to tend to his people, I think here in particular, we do have to take note that Jesus uses his elders and his deacons to tend to the needs of his people in the church. He shepherds us and feeds us through their ministry, not through the unmediated words of God from heaven, not through angels, not through dreams and visions, not even primarily through our own personal Bible readings, no, but through his elders, ordinary people in the church. That should put a slightly different perspective on our grumbling against those in leadership over us that we are perhaps prone to from time to time. We realize that those who are teaching us, they are shepherding on behalf of the chief shepherd. So consider who feeds the crowd. Now consider what the crowd are fed with. What the crowd are fed with. 5 loaves and 2 fish. And you wouldn't be surprised if there was a bit of laughter among the disciples as they found themselves looking down into that basket of supplies. Because there's no getting around the fact that those 5 loaves and 2 fish are a little bit meagre, both in their quantity and in their variety, for 5,000 hungry men. It's not exactly the scale and quality and quantity of Herod's banquet that we considered in the last passage. And to be honest, the way in which this passage presents this miracle, it doesn't really even present it much like a miracle. We're not really told that the disciples are amazed by this. We're not even told that the crowds are amazed by this like they are on other occasions. Indeed, you wonder sometimes whether the crowd have even noticed what's taken place. It just happens so casually. These 5 loaves and 2 fish are just dished up and distributed. Everyone has their fill, and then on we go. And again, I point us to our own spiritual food, and I say, is this not a bit like our own experience of being fed by the preaching and teaching of God's word in our own weekly church services? I mean, it's not as if preaching appears all that spectacular, all that miraculous, does it? I mean, if most people had the choice between watching the latest James Bond film or listening to a man standing in a pulpit speaking for 40 minutes on the meaning of an ancient document, you'd think that most people would go for the film. Or if you asked most people what they considered to equip them best for life, either a law degree at Oxford University or weekly church services in a little evangelical church which meets in a comprehensive school down the road, you'd think that most people would say the law degree at Oxford. Preaching is not what most people would consider to be either appetizing or filling, and it certainly doesn't look miraculous. That's why the Apostle Paul can describe it as the foolishness of preaching in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. It has an apparent futility to it, which it's difficult to see behind. And yet this teaching and preaching is precisely the way in which Jesus chooses to feed his people. Grasp this for a moment. The glorious God of the universe, the one who has designed the most colourful and lively and ingenious aspects of this creation, the one who, if he wanted to, could speak to his people through experiences so intense and ecstatic that they would make psychedelic drugs look like child's play, that wonderful, beautiful, great God chooses to feed us through something as ordinary and as casual and as seemingly unmiraculous as this, as preaching. Which brings us then to our third consideration. Consider the outcome. Consider the outcome. Look at verse 42. And they all ate and were satisfied. Their meal looked so unpromising, to the point of ridiculous, and yet it satisfied them. And I think probably it satisfied the disciples too. When I was at the Banner of Truth conference a couple of weeks ago, someone pointed out something which I'd never noticed before in this passage. They were preaching from this passage, and they made the point that these 12 disciples, who begin the passage without having the leisure to eat in verse 31, end the passage in verse 43 with these 12 big baskets of bread, almost like it's one each for each of the disciples. Plenty of bread to leave each of them satisfied. And the same then should be true for our preaching. On the surface level, it looks nearly impossible that such a plain activity as this should be able to keep a soul alive. But it does. That doesn't mean it's always exciting, but it should be filling. It should be satisfying. And to be satisfied in the long term is surely better than to be excited in the short term. So we need to remind ourselves of this. There are Sundays, aren't there, where the prospect of coming to church isn't particularly appealing. We doubt the real benefit of it. We find ourselves looking for excuses, and it almost seems like a bit of a relief when we discover that we have a good reason not to go. And it's at times like that, then, when we tell ourselves that all we're really missing out on is a scrap of bread and a few flakes of fish. But let me just remind you again that what we are missing out on when we do not come here is a divine miracle. Because there's a miracle at work when one sits under the preaching of the word. It's not obvious. You don't notice it really. But as soon as you engage with the spoken word of God, as soon as you listen to it and receive it, you are being filled. So don't underestimate Jesus' provision to you. Recognize it for what it is. Come to the church with your mouth wide open, willing to receive, your stomach ready to be filled. And if you do that, you will be. He will provide. So we've considered the pity of Jesus, the provision of Jesus. And then thirdly and finally, let us see the presence of Jesus. The presence of Jesus. So this feeding of the 5,000 takes place. Jesus then puts his disciples into the boat, sends them to the other side of the lake, dismisses the crowd, and goes up onto the mountain to pray. And then we have this incident in verses 47 to 52, which takes place on the lake. And you're probably thinking as we reach this point in the sermon, was it really helpful for me to read out this second part of the passage? Have we really got time to discuss the feeding of the 5,000 and Jesus walking on water? And probably we don't really have time to do both of those things justice. Probably I could have dealt with it in another sermon. But I did want us to realize this, that Mark seems to think that this incident on the lake with Jesus walking on the water is relevant to the story that we've just considered. How do I know that? Well, he brings up the matter again of the feeding of the 5,000 at the end of the passage in verses 51 and 52. Just look at those verses again. And he got into the boat with them, and the wind ceased, and they were utterly astounded, for they did not understand about the loaves, but their hearts were hardened. See, the disciples' experience on this lake has something to do with their experience on the land. To be specific, verses 51 and 52 seem to be telling us that the reason the disciples are so troubled and overcome by the events which take place on the lake is because they failed to understand the feeding of the 5,000. And the reason, it seems, they failed to understand the feeding of the 5,000 is because their hearts were hardened. So what do we make of that? What do we make of the fact that they didn't understand? In what sense were their hearts hardened? Well, I'll say this, that this won't be the last time we are told that the disciples fail to understand a mass feeding miracle like this one. Turn over for a moment to chapter 8 of this epistle, of this gospel. Chapter 8, the feeding of the 4,000 takes place in that chapter. And once it's happened, the disciples in verse 14 get back on their boat. Except for the fact that we're told there they had forgotten to take bread with them. And they're clearly agitated about this. Jesus, however, doesn't seem to be very agitated about this. He changes the subject and he wants to talk about the leaven of the Pharisees. But here's the thing. The disciples, who are still fretting about the bread, once again start talking about the issue of the bread in verse 16. The fact that they don't have any bread with them. To which Jesus responds in verse 17, why are you discussing the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember when I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take? They said to him, 12. And the 7 for the 4,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take? And they said to him, 7. And he said to them, do you not yet understand? So what don't they understand in Mark chapter 8 about the feeding of the multitudes, and therefore they don't understand in our passage in Mark chapter 6? Well, they don't understand many things, but one thing that they don't understand, I think, is that this, in the presence of Jesus the shepherd, physical provision is not something to fret about. These disciples have witnessed thousands of mouths being filled with a few meagre rations, and now already they are fretting about their own lack of bread. And the fact of the matter is, in Mark chapter 8, that fretting is now starting to become a real problem, a problem of the heart. It's not simply a reasonable emotional state stemming from a lack of evidence, a lack of trust in Jesus. No, here we're told that their hearts were hardened. Hardened in the sense, I think, that deep down within them, there is still part of them which is resistant to the idea that Jesus can and will provide for them. Perhaps we might even say that some part of them dares to think that they were really responsible for that supply of bread and fish. That if it wasn't for them keeping Jesus in check, thousands might still all be hungry. Maybe that's quite an appealing idea for these men. we are okay, we are self-sufficient, we can do it on our own. And while then they have no difficulty at all with the idea that Jesus is this authoritative teacher, that he's a moral role model, or even that he's this mighty messianic king who has power over death itself, they struggle with this idea that he is their shepherd, the provider of all things, even their very food and drink. And so in our passage then, in Mark 6, as these 12 men leave the shore and leave Jesus and the multitudes and go on the lake, even after all they've witnessed, there's still an awful lot of maturing to do. Ultimately, their hardened, self-sufficient hearts, I think in this passage, are exposed in this cacophony of fretful, anxious emotions which take place on the lake. In them coming to this bizarre conclusion that they're seeing Jesus' ghost, and then the terror that they have afterwards, and then this state of utter bewilderment as Jesus calms the storm. That whole emotional state is revealing the fact that they never really understood about the loaves. They never really grasped the full extent of Jesus' provision of them. They were still trusting too much in themselves. So how does Jesus then begin to deal with that self-sufficient heart which leaves the lakeside and the feeding of the 5,000 in the boat? Well, I want to finish by considering that question. And the answer simply is, firstly, I think, by setting them out onto that stormy lake by themselves, which ultimately reminds them that they're not as self-sufficient as they thought they were, and then by comforting them with a mighty display of his own divine presence and providing for them in all of their struggles. That's why my third heading is Jesus' presence. It's interesting how at the end of verse 48, after Jesus sees these disciples struggling on the water, perhaps he's looking down from the mountain, maybe it's a moonlit lake, and he can see them on the water in their boat. After he sees them there, he walks down onto the water to them, and then at the end of verse 48, it says, he meant to pass them by. He meant to pass them by. Why does Jesus mean to pass them by? Well, it reminds me a little bit of being on holiday up at Loch Carron in Scotland with our friends. Sometimes my brother and one of our friends would go out onto the loch in a kayak. And I remember how my friend's dad would often be quite sort of anxious about this, and he'd come out and he'd take his binoculars to the shoreline, and he'd be constantly watching the boat as it went out onto the loch. He'd be constantly keeping an eye on them, and sometimes they'd pass behind an island, and it'd be a little while before they reappeared, and you could see he was getting anxious, and he'd pace along the shoreline, and he'd find himself sort of trying to look around the back of the island, getting into a position where he could make sure that they were safe. And you know then that if he felt like he had the power to, he would have walked straight out onto that lake and he would have looked over around the back of the island to see where they'd got to. And perhaps there's a little bit of that attitude in Jesus. He walks over to sort of check up on them, to make sure they're okay. It's another little indication of his sense of responsibility and compassion. He just passes by to just make sure they're all right. Perhaps there's something of that there. But I think there's another reason why we're told he passes by. And I think it's this. He passes by for their sake. In one sense, it's just this little intended nod of encouragement. Don't worry, I'm here, you can see me. Just keep on going, keep on rowing like I told you to. Yes, it's a struggle, but I'm here, I'll meet you on the other side. But at the same time, it's something much mightier than even that, because where else in the scriptures do we encounter that expression, passing by? Well, for one thing, we see it with Moses. We see it with Moses being commanded by God to leave Sinai with the people of God and head out to the promised land, Exodus chapter 33. And Moses in that situation is anxious. And what's he anxious about? He's anxious that God's presence will not go with the people on the journey onwards, as they make their way through the desert to the promised land. And he says to God, if your presence will not go with me, do not bring us up from here. That's what he says. And God assures him that his presence will accompany Moses. How does he assure him? Well, God says this in verse 19 of that chapter. He says, I will make all my goodness pass before you and will proclaim before you my name, the Lord. That is Yahweh, the I am. And I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious. And I will show mercy on whom I will show mercy. And God goes on and he says, behold, there is a place by me where you shall stand on the rock. And while my glory passes by, I will put you in a cleft of the rock. And I will cover you with my hand until I have passed by. You see, Moses' guarantee of God's future presence with Israel is in this wonderful passing by. In a way that only really Moses will ever understand, the very goodness of God passes by him. And he is assured then that he doesn't go onto this journey alone, but he goes with the presence of God with him at all times. And so who is it then that passes by the disciples on Lake Galilee? Well, I would put it to you that the passage is telling us the one who passes by the disciples is the very one who Job speaks of in chapter 9 of that book as the one who stretched out the heavens and trampled the waves of the sea. Yahweh himself is effortlessly marching past to the other side of this lake. He's overtaking his struggling disciples. He's displaying his goodness and his provision to them. And while the tragedy then is that these disciples in their blindness fail to see the glory of God and instead see just a ghost, the glory of God does not respond by marching onwards and continuing to pass by and leave them in that mess. No, rather he doesn't simply pass by, he comes over to them. And in spite of their hardness and their stubbornness, Jesus walks over and the very presence of God in all of his compassionate goodness, gets into that boat with them. And he calms the storm and he says, take heart, it is I, do not be afraid. I mean, who else has the authority to make that kind of statement? Who else could remove all anxiety with that little phrase, it is I? A phrase which in the Greek is literally, I am, the name of God himself. Only Jesus has the ability to do that. And so let me just comfort you this evening, wherever Jesus has you in this life right now, whatever duties you have, whatever that looks like, however you are serving him, whatever responsibilities you've been given, simply remember, he is there. His presence is never far. You are safe. And if you, like these disciples, are prone to this hardness of heart, this state of self-sufficiency, I can do this on my own, well, remember, let us all remember as the church this evening that our survival does not depend on our own ability to keep going. Rather, it depends on the presence of God with us. We are not feeding ourselves. We're not the ones working the miracles amongst ourselves, keeping the body of Christ living and breathing. No, the very presence of God is here with us. He is supplying us with every provision. He is keeping us safe. He is keeping us alive. And only he then enables us to do what we do. And let us remember then that great promise that this very presence of God, Jesus Christ, will never leave us nor forsake us. He will be with his people until our dying day. Amen.